So at that point, we were a bit stumped. What could they have found? And we thought the only way to find out is to go right back in time and reconstruct the mindset of the people that were around at the time. Because if anything was buried in Herod's temple, it had to be buried around the time of Jesus and his brother James, because there was a tiny window of opportunity. Herod's temple was being built whilst Jesus was alive, and it wasn't even finished when his brother James died in 62 AD. It was only just finished when it was destroyed in 70 AD. So you can bury scrolls beneath a half-finished temple. So perhaps there was about a 30-year window or something like that. But it was certainly, anything that was buried there at the time of Jesus and James. We were still doing private research here, remember? So anyone that was doing a more serious study wouldn't have done what we did and just take a leap backwards. But we went back to the land of summer. That's the earliest point that you can get in history, or so we thought at the time, because that's when writing was invented, sort of 6,000 years ago, between the land called Summer, which is between the Tigris and Euphrates, which of course is largely now Iraq. And although it was once the Garden of Eden, if you like, the cradle of civilization, it's sad to say that it was the area that was had to be carpet bombed during the war with Saddam Hussein. And unfortunately as well, the Mandians that are there may or may not still be alive, because Saddam Hussein is conducting genocide against them. So this living fossil of the Jerusalem church may be lost, or at least heavily damaged. So we looked at this civilization of Sumer. They were great people. They invented writing, or so we believe. They invented the wheel. They invented glass. They invented metalworking. They were very, very skilled at many crafts. And they left behind very detailed records on their tablets of clay. Their theology is interesting. It seemed that the really important unit of theology to them was the pillar, a freestanding pillar, not part of a building, which was a sort of artificial mountain, which was an umbilical to connect heaven with earth. And we could see a radiating effect of this belief traveling into different places, to Turkey, to Egypt. And we next looked at the Egyptian civilization to see how that connected and what they had taken from the land of Sumer, remembering that Abraham came from Sumer rather later. He came from the city of Ur, one of the principal cities, and went up to Egypt with his wife. And it was also interesting that Abraham talks of the God of our fathers. Now, the origin of that is that each individual Sumerian had originally their own personal god, sort of inside them, that they related to. But as they had children, their children would often adopt their father's god. And so it would go on generation after generation. So you'd have a little clan that all had their sort of family god. And that what they would call the god of their fathers. So there were lots of gods, but Abraham's was his own. And as he went north towards Egypt, that is what he was referring to, his personal family god. So we looked at Egypt to see if we could get any sort of clues there, because that's heavily interrelated with Sumer at one end and with the nation of the Jews at the other. And it was immediately very interesting, because 3200 BC, Egypt suddenly sprung almost from nowhere into existence. It was the union of two countries, we're told, Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt. Upper Egypt in the south, because it was in the mountains where the Nile flowed from, and Lower Egypt in the north on the Mediterranean coast. Now, each of those two countries had their pillar, their single pillar that connected them with God. And when they united the two countries together, they had a problem, this new united Egypt, in which one was going to lose the pillar, because they really only needed one. And they solved it by keeping them both. Now, in Lower Egypt, which was the older of the two countries, the principal city, which is now in a suburb of Cairo, is known in the Bible as the city of On, the priestly city of On, or Heliopolis, as the Greeks called it. But it was originally called Anu. And that's interesting because it has a meaning, of course, and Anu means pillar. It's simply pillar. Now, its counterpart city in Upper Egypt was Southern Pillar. So it was very clear the great importance of pillars to them. Now, we believe that they kept both those pillars because they saw them as like lintels holding up the sky god Nut. Because those two lands in Egypt are north and south, those pillars faced east towards the rising sun and towards the rising morning star as well. Now, in Freemasonry, we're told that the one pillar stands for strength, and the other pillar stands for founding, the founding pillar, the original one, and one united stability. Now, that's how the two pillars of Solomon's temple are described, but that is exactly what the ancient Egyptians got. They believed that when those two pillars, when those two lands were put together, they would have stability. And if they were ever parted, they would lose that stability, and that is exactly what happened, as I'll come on to shortly. So there was a sort of connection, speculative at this stage, certainly, between ancient Egypt and its interest in pillars and the pillars of Freemasonry. It was certainly enough to make us to look rather deeper and further at ancient Egypt. We found that they had a remarkable principle, something called Ma'at, which had been in Egypt from the very beginning, from 5,200 years ago. And Ma'at was an idea of doing good for good's sake. It was morality outside of religion, which is very rare. And they likened Ma'at to being square and upright like the foundations of a temple. The whole description was identical to Freemasonry. You could not divide the definition of either. Ma'at and Freemasonry were totally synonymous. And that's, as far as we are aware, completely unique, because most moral codes come out of religious belief or some religious framework. Whereas the idea in Freemasonry and the idea in Ma'at is doing good for good's sake. And Egyptian kings would be eventually measured on their ability to do Ma'at. And eventually, Ma'at was turned into a goddess. But for a long, long time, it stood alone as an abstract concept. So here we had something that which was quite a remarkable connection, and we were increasingly convinced that there was something here. Because in Freemasonry today, the imagery is ancient Egyptian, and the claim of antiquity that is in the rituals is that it comes from ancient Egypt. It's just that no one believes it. So it looked as though the claim was genuine. We looked at the king-making rituals of ancient Egypt, or what is known about them, and there's a great deal known. The king is, when he's made a king, is given a collar and an apron, just as a mason is. He's conducted around the country, which is symbolically inside the temple, exactly as it happens in the Masonic temple, around the four points of the compass. But no one knew exactly, and it has often been a mystery, of what it was that actually made somebody the king of ancient Egypt. Because when the old king died, there was a period of instability when someone else could usurp the throne, because they could only hold the rituals on certain dates. But once someone was made the king of Egypt, that was it. No one would ever challenge them. So something very special happened, and that's never been understood. We think we found the explanation for it. Now, I will mention here the actual story of the founding of Egypt, which is the little legend of Osiris and his killing. Osiris was attacked by his brother Set, who wanted his power, and he was cut into pieces and his body put into the Nile. And Isis, their sister, gathered together those parts of Osiris and breathed life into his body long enough to mount him and impregnate herself, because the brothers and sisters, of course, were required to marry to keep the bloodline pure. So she became pregnant from this briefly resurrected God, who then departed to rule in the land of the dead and shine as the stars, as it says in Freemasonry, forever and ever. And the offspring that was born is known as the Horus. And Horus, when he grew to manhood as a young man, did battle with his uncle Set. And in that terrible battle, the Horus lost an eye, and Set lost his testicles. Very inconvenient. But this was a battle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness, and it was said to be a non-decisive battle, and therefore that battle would continue at all times. And at night, the forces of darkness would magnify, and during the day, the forces of goodness would magnify. Now, the Horus was the name of the king of Egypt. He was a god. His father was Osiris, and he was Horus. And when he died, he became the new Osiris, and his son became the new Horus. And therefore, he was the son of God. And all kings were later to be described as the son of God, which is not unique to the man we call Jesus Christ. And also an important description in Freemasonry is the son of the widow. Now, the Horus was very much the son of the widow, because his mother was widowed even before he was conceived, which is an unusual arrangement. I believe it can be achieved these days, but then it must have been unique. So, again, there were connections with Freemasonry, and of course the connections with all religions thereafter, that the son of God, the king, was in some way the son of God. Now, we looked at the actual resurrection ceremony, which we believe at the one point was conducted inside the Great Pyramid on the Giza Plateau, and that it was a resurrection ceremony. That when the king died, he became Osiris, and he was embalmed, mummified, and he was duly taken to the land of the dead. But we believe, and we've had a lot of support from this from people that know a great deal about ancient Egypt, that the Horus travelled with him, that he went to a temporary death, that his son lay side by side on the night of the ritual, and with the use of drugs, no doubt, went into a catatonic state and was believed to have departed, so that his father could show him the route to the heavens, the stars, to meet the past gods of Egypt, and there to be made a god. Because you can crown a king, but who can make a god? Only other gods can create a god. So we believe that they thought that the new Horus travelled to the land of the dead there to be created a god himself. And when he returned in the morning with the light of the morning star, the alignment of the shaft in the pyramid is such that the light of the morning star, as it breaks over the Sinai, comes straight down that shaft into the body of the Horus. Now that explains a lot. That would explain why after that ceremony no one would argue with him, because he was believed to be absolutely a god who had been created a god in the heavens. Now, we speculated when we wrote the book that the drugs would have been used, and very recently it's been found that mummies of that early period have got very strong traces of cocaine and nicotine inside in the bodies, and which is very strange for a number of reasons, most particularly that those are South American crops. They couldn't come from anywhere else. So without a shadow of a doubt, there was trade between South America and ancient Egypt, which of course has the scholars looking very puzzled. The way they deal with it is just to say, oh, I won't look at that. This vertical channeling. See, the Egyptologists really sprung out of the European, mostly people that ventured off in the last century to Egypt and looked at everything, dug everything up, and if they couldn't understand it, it was a tomb, because these were primitive people. We're the smart ones. We're the pinnacle of all God's creation. The idea that someone before may have known more than them would never cross their minds. And they look at ancient Egypt as though it was just stood alone. But of course it doesn't. It was connected with everything else. But they don't have this holistic approach, which is what we've tried to have in our work. And a lot of people are now trying to do. Now, it's interesting that the morning star, which is so important in Freemasonry and so important to the ancient Egyptians, was designated by a hieroglyph with a little flag and a five-pointed star, which had the literal meaning, sacred knowledge. Which is what the Horus, of course, achieved on his journey. We were really convinced at this point that we were onto something, that the bits were gluing together too well, that there was something in it. And so we looked for other glitches, and we focused on the Hyksos period, as it's called, the second period when there had been problems in ancient Egypt. Now this occurred, they dated at 1782 to 1570 BC, and the Hyksos were Asiatics that came into Egypt and occupied the country into Lower Egypt initially. And this is where they divided the two halves of the country again, and the stability was gone. They invaded. It wasn't a one-off invasion when they marched in. It was a slow sort of infiltration, because the country had gone into a low ebb. It had gone into social decline. Crime had gone up. Things just weren't working too well. And so these foreigners waltzed in. There were some battles. They did sack the odd city that stood against them, but by and large it was just a relatively peaceful grabbing of ancient Egypt, because the Egyptians were lovely people. They really were not warlike. They were pretty useless at war. They probably still are, in actual fact, but they were so friendly. They would allow people to come and share in their crops, to have their water in times of drought. They were good.